Hey, Christina.
Hey, Martin.
Hey, how's it going?
Oh, you know how it is. It's going great. How are you?
It's going well. Thanks for asking. This conversation seems very normal and natural.
Very normal conversation between human people who are human.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Persons, yeah.
Yeah, it really does. So, Christina, do you imagine that some weird nerds could find a way to systematize all the things that are very, very normal about our conversation, possibly by documenting it in exhaustive detail and writing 40 pages, half of which is footnotes about how normal conversations are, like normal people are having, like we are really normal right now?
I would be brokenhearted if there weren't nerds writing footnotes about our very normal conversation. That would devastate me to my core.
Well, then you're in luck, because I read about weird nerds who wanted to write about normal conversations.
I love weird nerds trying to figure out what is a normal conversation.
Awesome. Theme song.
Theme song.
All right, y'all. This is They Did What to What. This is a podcast where we talk about formative studies, mostly from psychology, by addressing primary sources.
Reading the literature.
Reading the literature, like a bunch of nerds. This nerd is named...
Fucking goddamn nerds.
Whoa.
Reading things.
Language. Are we swearing nerds?
No.
Oh, we should do stuff on swearing. There's some cool studies.
Is there
stuff
on swearing?
Some cool studies on swearing. We should do that later. Anyways, we're getting distracted. We're supposed to be introducing this episode, not future possible episodes that we might do 8 years from now.
What did I ask you to do for this episode, Martin?
But you just said my name, but I haven't introduced myself. The audience is going to be so confused. Who's she talking to? And who is she? Me, I'm Martin. I'm a comm studies scholar and professor. I used to be a psychology person. Got out of that racket. That other person who I was talking to, I probably called you Christina already, but that's Christina. Christina is a neuropharmacologist.
Ding, ding, ding.
Researcher.
And an adjunct professor.
Adjunct professor? Hell yeah. I don't know. It's cool for a while. And then I'm like, you can just use my name. Like, that's less weird, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyways, these two professors, these two professors are going to be talking about a study on interruptin today.
Should I interrupt you as you say that?
Yes. I think if you ask permission, it's too late.
Oh, well, all right. Yeah.
We'll make do with what we have. So, so Christina, on your invitation, we're doing an episode on interruptions, and in particular, the phenomenon of women getting interrupted by men in conversation.
Should I do my Tumblr-heavy introduction to the topic?
Oh, yeah. If you have one, that would be great.
It's extremely Tumblr-heavy, and I don't even use Tumblr, so I don't know how it came to be that way.
Is Tumblr still a thing?
I think for porn.
Oh, I thought they eliminated porn and that's why it died.
I think they tried to, and then it was just more of that. So, introduction to interruptions. I have heard this individual factoid over and over and over for probably over a decade. I've seen it on Tumblr, I've seen it on Twitter, I've seen it on TikTok, but I don't have TikTok, so I've seen the reposted YouTube shorts or whatever that have the TikTok logo still on them. And the gist of this factoid that I've seen over and over and over again is that men think that women are speaking an equal amount of time when women are speaking for 10% of the time, and men think that women are dominating the conversation when women are speaking for 30% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the numbers that mm-hmm. I've seen over and over again. I think sometimes it's 15% and 30%, but it's always men think that women dominate conversations when they're speaking for well less than half of the time. And
right.
I think it's in a classroom setting, but I've seen this posted over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And I found one Tumblr post that ended with, "Don't fuck with me, I'm a scientist." And in the Tumblr post, the person who posted this said that Dale Spencer, an Australian scholar, did a study.
Yes.
And she said that Dale Spencer's study was published in the book Learning to Lose.
Yes.
And the Tumblr post specifically mentioned the chapter. So I checked out from an interlibrary loan, which mean that the book had to be shipped across the country to get to me.
Yeah.
Learning to Lose. I was so excited. Yeah. I was so giddy running to the library, being like, absolutely, I'm going to get the study. I'm going to get the source. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get the origin of this information.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Read the chapter.
Yep.
It's not in there.
It's not. No, it certainly isn't. So rather than getting an interlibrary loan, I found a copy, might have been like archive.org or something, where I could check it out. And yeah, it's there. That is not a book of original studies.
So I checked out two copies of Man-Made Language, which I believe was Dale Spender's thesis.
Got that too. Yeah. Yep, got that
one too. So I have two versions just in case. It wasn't in one version, but it was in the other version.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I have the interlibrary loan of Learning to Lose, which is a collection of like essays by different feminist scholars.
Exactly.
Not in there.
No.
I have a stack of books that promised me the source of this information.
Wait a minute. It sounds like you said that you got books by Dale Spender. You needed books by Dale Spencer.
Yeah, so the Tumblr post was wrong, and then the Tumblr post ended with, "Don't fuck with me, I'm a scientist." And it was from a very passionate place.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
It was from this very good place, very like caring about communication.
Yeah.
And I very much, if I was an asshole, I would have commented a note saying, parentheses, Dale Spender.
Right.
Close parentheses.
"Don't fuck with me, I'm a scientist" is actually pretty ironic too, because one of the things that Dale Spender does in Man-Made Language is offer an interesting critique of like science or science discourses in terms of their assertions of truth. So, and we're going to talk about that a little bit today. So,
have you heard that tidbit before?
I've heard that a number of times. I used to teach interpersonal communication, and one of the chapters basically opens with, "We all hear that men speak more or women speak more than men, but clearly the opposite is true. They will sometimes like cite things that support that, very rarely with the exact numbers that we're hearing about, and very often they'll offer some kind of explanation for it that is just sort of unsatisfying." For example, I remember in our interpersonal book, the authors made the argument that, men think that because men work outside the house. And so they are all out in the office, out in the world, talking all day. And so when they get home, they just want peace and quiet. And so it feels to them like women talk too much. It's just an honest mistake. No need to critique patriarchy. And so like that's been my experience with it, is that it doesn't seem to be true. And you can make up all kinds of reasons why it is an understandable error to make.
It's such a strange concept because there's so many different situations where you can put your study. You can put, do men talk more than women in the home? Do men talk more than women at work? Do men talk more than women at a grocery store? And like just record everything. But what? It's just strange. It's very strange.
It is. And so I set off to kind of look at this and
my question of if this study exists, where did this study come from?
Yeah. And so I started with Dale Spender as well, discovered that Spender is not a like kind of quantitative scholar who would give us percentages like that. She does, or has done, did.
Did she die?
Yeah. Just before we were originally going to record this.
Oh my God.
But yeah.
She heard we were going to talk about it and was like, no, I don't need to be here for this actually. I don't want to know what these two assholes are going to say about my life's work.
Oh my God. Right? Yeah. I'm out.
Rest in peace, Dale Spender.
Yeah, so I read her work and was like, oh, I don't find anything close to what has been asserted. And part of what we are doing on this show specifically is reading
primary literature.
yeah, that's the premise of the show, and it's fun to do that. So what I ended up doing is reading man-made language, really enjoying it, and then locating some of the sources that Spender used to talk about men interrupting women.
Yeah. So Dale Spender, most of her work is like compilation work, which is extremely, extremely important work.
It
which
is
like reviewing things and taking a look at a field as a whole and seeing what conclusions come when you look at all of the studies studying an individual area. What is the conclusion together that they come to? So it's not a fault of Dale Spender to not be a primary researcher.
Oh, no, not at all. No. Yeah.
She's a reviewer, right?
Right. Yeah, and a critical reviewer, too.
Yeah.
So she's not doing like meta-analyses or anything where she's taking quantitative work and drawing, again, statistically supportable conclusions from them. She's a critical reviewer. So she is reading all these studies and then telling a story that makes sense within a particular particular lens, a particular understanding of the conditions of power, authority, and identity that we live in today. And so that was actually one of the things that was interesting about reading her work, is that a lot of this stuff is at this weird intersection between psychology, communication studies, linguistics. And so apropos of the last study I presented, which was on the Dunning-Kruger effect, I'm really aware of where I am not an expert in this field, because I am a communication scholar, but I am not a communication scholar the way that Dale Spender was, or in the way that many of the studies that she cites are. Communication studies, oddly, maybe this, I don't know, we'll cut this out if it's not interesting, but you know, it kind of itself has this amalgam of different methodologies and beyond methodologies, paradigms that it works through. So some folks are quantitative scholars. They're going to observe a phenomenon. They're going to design a study by breaking down elements of the phenomenon into variables that are measurable. You know, other scholars in communication studies who do qualitative analyses. And then there are rhetorical or critical scholars. And that's what I am. So again, like kind of like what Spender is talking about, where I spend most of my time is, again, looking at phenomenon and talking about how they fit within a broader cultural narrative. However, the sources I look at tend not to be scientific studies themselves, but tend to be cultural objects. So I start with a cultural object. And Spender is doing this kind of critical analysis of scientific studies.
What is a cultural object?
So for example, one of the things that I was obsessed with for a while, this is before he became kind of a nightmare, but I was...
Are you about to say Kanye West?
I am. I was...
George Bush doesn't care about black people?
I am, yeah. I was...
Oh my God, yeah.
I was obsessed with that. For a while, I was convinced that that was the most important piece of political oratory of the 21st century.
No, I think it is. I agree with you. Like Kanye West being who he is now, obviously is very divorced from the impact of that statement.
Yes.
But oh my God, that statement.
Yeah. And so, you know, if you've got a spare 3.5 hours, I will talk to you about the significance of that, you know, throughout the Western oratorical tradition.
Yeah, let's do a bonus 3.5 hour episode.
I would love to hear
so much more about
that. Yeah, strap on your Cicero pants, because we're going back to the Roman Republic.
Oh my God, I think I was 12. What year was that?
2005.
So I was 15. And oh my God, like the impact, the awareness, the discourse, everything that happened because of that, it was so much. And it was incredible. It was truly incredible.
Like the interaction between him and Michael Myers is the horror figure. I always forget. Their interaction is
a phenomenon.
It was a true cultural phenomenon. And so that's where I spend my time is talking about how that is situated within a story that we can tell about our culture.
Can we talk about how we've interrupted Dale Spender to talk about men?
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. one of the big things we're been talking about is topic selection and how interruptions play into that. So,
yep.
Okay. So as I was reading Spender's Man-Made Language, I got to the bit about interruption. And so I decided that I would dig into some of the sources that she cites there and look at the work they did. So, but before that, we should talk about who Dale Spender was. We've been kind of hinting around this, but Dale Spender was an Australian feminist scholar, cultural theorist, an author of several books. She was a teacher. She did a lot of anti-poverty activism as well. She, in general, seemed to be sort of delightful, by most accounts.
Yeah.
You know,
and I appreciated her writing so much because it was one of those types of writings that you don't have to be a communication scholar to understand what she's saying.
Yeah.
She spoke in such a straightforward, like, let's call a cat a cat. Let's call a bookshelf a bookshelf.
Yeah.
Right? This is just what it is.
This is another thing about her work is that she was doing a type of kind of feminist criticism that almost would be at home on something like Tumblr now. She really was doing a very accessible version of feminist criticism, and Man-Made Language is written in 1980. So so this was, a lot of the things she's citing just happened. And so we'll talk about some of that too. She's talking about the creation of the term sexual harassment, and it had just happened. So yeah, so we'll talk about some of that stuff at the end. But she was born in 1943 and then died in 2023. So 80 years old, but really kind of spanning the heart of the late 20th century feminist movement. What would largely consider the second wave feminist movement was her period of great activity. So so I'm going to give just a little bit of a summary of some of the stuff that I located in Man-Made Language that led me down the path we're going to get on here. So broadly speaking, Man-Made Language argues that patriarchy structures language to the advantage of men speakers. Not terribly controversial at this point, but in 1980, she's telling people something that they might not already know.
Yeah, introducing the concept, I feel like it, even today, it's not accepted that this is a real thing, right?
That's true.
And I have two versions of Man-Made Language. I have the original version and then an updated version.
Oh, very cool.
And she wrote an introduction to the updated version saying that in the writing of Man-Made Language, as she went back to review it for the updated version, she realized the pitfalls that she fell into while she was writing Man-Made Language that she talked about in the book. So she talked about how she was writing Man-Made Language to appeal to her thesis committee, to appeal to men, to make it palatable to men, to make it acceptable to men.
Yeah.
And the introduction is like, so I knew all those concepts and I still did it. I still behaved in that way, which I thought was so cool. And that's why I check multiple versions of books out of the library because they have so much information in the updating.
Yeah. And I think that's an important part of like the ethos of her work, and probably an important ethos to bear in mind as we do this episode. You know, for people listening, you probably do a bunch of this stuff. And
all of it. I do all of this.
Yeah. And, you know, there are kind of, I don't know, we might say misogynist implications to it. But many of us are doing it like by accident. Accident's not the right word. Many of us are doing it despite knowing better. And in fact, part of the analysis then is that it's not an accident. It's structurally intentional. You are going to do it. The world is set up so that you do it. So I don't know. I guess what I'm saying is none of this, or at least my intention isn't to like,
it's not pick a personal fault.
Yeah. Cause it's not a personal
fault.
It's a structural fault.
Yeah.
No, precisely. And Spender does a pretty good job of foregrounding that. And the article we're going to be talking about does a good job of foregrounding that, though for, I think, different reasons. And, okay. So Spender's main argument is that patriarchy structures language to the advantage of men. She kind of notes that our linguistic norms reward men for dominating conversations, for dominating social situations in general. They reward women for being passive, which allows men to continue dominating, and then tells women, well, if you don't want to be dominated, why don't you adopt, you know, masculine speech characteristics, for which they are then punished. It's a situation where you can't win.
Yeah, I am so hyper aware that this episode, we have one man and one woman, and we're going to be talking about methods of language and communication. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, shit, what do I do? Do I do a feminine method of communication? Do I dominate communication and be masculine and perform masculinity and win the podcast? How do I win this podcast?
But then the audience, of course, is going to judge you negatively for doing that. So
I will be judged negatively for being masculine.
Yeah, right. But then if you aren't, everyone's going to be like, ugh. Did you hear Christina? She was just sitting
back.
She
didn't even know.
Yeah, exactly. She wasn't knowledgeable, didn't care, just let herself be run over. So like, I don't know.
She only has 3 Dale Spender books. Did she even read Dale Spender?
Are people going to call you out on your Dale Spender t-shirt?
Name 3 studies cited by Dale Spender.
Bro, do you even Spender? Okay, so this is one of the things that she's really interested in, is how this is kind of taking place in the everyday world. One of the other important things she notes, and I think we actually brought this up a little bit ago, is that one of the things the language does is kind of creates reality. Language doesn't just describe reality, but it helps create reality by naming phenomena, which allows us to then interact with them. If you don't have a name for a thing, it can be really hard to talk about that thing. And so the way we name things influences how we approach them. This is a variation on or a version of what's called the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, which made the very strong claim that like different languages like mean you live in a totally different world than people in other speech communities.
You unlock new ideas, right?
Yeah. My sense is that most folks don't go quite as far as the original Sapir-Whorf hypothesis goes. You know, there is an empirical world beyond language, and also the differences between languages aren't so totalizing. But
well, according to our Pavlov episode, things can be translated so poorly as to completely change the original meaning of the work or the intention.
Absolutely. Yeah. So again, I think most people at this point, any linguists who want to correct me, but I think most people at this point agree that yes, language structures reality to some extent. I think it's a rare person who denies that at this point. But one of the implications of that is that language can never then be neutral or objective. Language is always taking a stand. Any way that you talk influences the outcome, and it's never neutral. Another thing that Spender does in Man-Made Language is she talks about the adoption of our grammatical norms. And in particular, one I focused, I thought was most interesting and most relevant to our conversation, is things like the idea that he and man are neutral in English. So, you know, you'll talk about, you know, congressmen, which includes, you know, congress people, you know, representatives of all genders, right?
In a silly but not very silly example is in Star Trek, they call everyone sir, even the women are called sir,
right,
as a sign of respect, because what is more respectable than being a man?
Being a sir. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So I was just teaching about this actually in my gender comm class this week. And they talked about a study where they gave a bunch of children a book titled, or a chapter of a book that was titled like A Great Man. And they were supposed to put pictures in to that chapter. And they put almost, you know, basically put all pictures of men in that chapter. But then when they said like, you know, a great person, it turns out they put like, you know, 68% pictures of men in the chapter, or, you know, 50 something percent. It was more than half, but like also there was a bunch of women that show up, like just demonstrating again, obviously, to anyone who cares to look, that even if we think man is, you know, neutral, people don't construct the world that way. So, and so Spender's case is first that, but then also she gives a really interesting kind of history of how we even came to think of he and man as neutral. That this is a traceable historical grammatical project, which is, again, is so great, right? Because she's noting not only that it happened and that it's true, but like that there was a process that made it the way it is. And and I think what I like about that is it just notes how it could then be undone. And so one of the important elements then is that she is extending the work of philosophers of science by saying that all of these things about language being having this kind of male skew, male bias, is true even of science. She says in Man-Made Language, theory precedes observation. I think we talked about that at some point too. Like, there's no such thing as atheoretical research, right? So theory precedes observation. And the types of theories that are culturally available play a substantial role in determining what the observers, empirical scientists among them, can see. When there is a sexist language and sexist theories culturally available, the observation of reality is also likely to be sexist. It is by this means that sexism can be perpetuated and reinforced as new objects and events, new data, have sexist interpretations projected upon them. Science is no more free of this bias than any other explanatory activity.
As a science example, I'm a neuropharmacologist, mm-hmm. so I study neuropharmacology every single day of my life. And very recently, only very, very recently, did the NIH, the government of the United States of America, mandate that men and women have to be equally represented in clinical trials, in studies mm-hmm. of drugs yeah. and the treatment of things. And the default before that was assuming yeah. men have fewer hormones, so they're better subjects. That's not even true, right? I'm just
fewer
saying.
Fewer hormones.
Yeah. They're less hormonal, they have less variation. So men are better as a subject. So we'll do all of our studies in men because it'll be easier.
That's amazing.
And then we'll just use those same results and use them for women.
That's
and there was
amazing.
A huge paper that came out a few years ago saying that women are consistently and continuously overdosed for almost every medication across the
wow.
board. They receive too much,
wow.
so they experience more side
right,
effects
of course.
In a way that's not explained by weight.
Right.
So it's not that women, quote unquote, weigh less
right.
and therefore they're
right.
being overdosed in
right.
that way. It's if you account for
right.
differences in body weight, they're still being overdosed and they're still having unnecessary side effects
right.
because all of these drugs were studied
only
in men.
Wow.
And that's only in the past. It's not even 10 years old that this has happened.
So this is written in 1980 and still, like, you know, relevant, paying off, a thing we need to pay attention to 45 years later. And so we can talk about that as well. When we get to the end, we can talk a little bit about that as well. You know, to what extent the study managed to, or was constrained by, you know, kind of the language of science.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that Spender talks about then in Man-Made Language is interruption. She notes that interruption serves a number of purposes in conversation. And her analysis, again, as a feminist scholar of language, is that in general, interruption is a mechanism that allows men to kind of take and keep control of a conversation. And this is ironic because, as we said, you know, earlier on, there's this idea that men talk less than women. Women are always, you know, blah, 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 talking, right? But she knows that, like, there's no, evidence this is true. You can't find any studies that say it's true, and you can find many studies that say it's false.
Well, they should come study my wife.
Hey! Hey-o!
I'm sorry, that's just so funny.
Do you have more jokes?
Yes, I do. I have the entire Rodney Dangerfield collection just queued up. I have a tab open with everything he's ever said. And my goal is to interject and interrupt you with as many Rodney Dangerfield jokes as I possibly can. Rodney Dangerfield said, "Take my wife," right? He's that guy?
Not originally. I believe that was...
Oh, okay.
I believe that was Henny Youngman.
That's not a real name.
You wouldn't
name,
think
I'm
so,
sorry.
Right? No, but I believe Henny Youngman is... I'm not an expert on this. however, I think that was kind of a Borscht Belt stand-up trope, was the kind of take my wife bit. And Henny Youngman mm-hmm. is part of that crew. And he's the one who kind of gets credit for it, is my recollection.
Study my wife, please.
Exactly. One of the studies that Spender cites in her discussion of interruptions is a study by Zimmerman and West, Don Zimmerman and Candace West. And so Spender notes that according to Zimmerman and West, men make 98% of the interruptions in man-woman conversations. Women don't even think this is inappropriate, much less protest, and that men deny women the normal conversational turns to which they're entitled. They also deny women the privilege of selecting topics. So this is kind of Spender's analysis of the Zimmerman and West article. And this is something that I've also seen references to before. I believe this was cited in my GenderCom textbook that I use. It was cited in the interpersonal textbook that I used. So the Zimmerman West study is notable because it seems to be the earliest study about interruptions, cross-gender interruptions. The results were very, very striking, but it's interesting to see what kind of claims they actually felt comfortable making from this study. So the study was called Sex Roles, Interruption, and Silences in Conversation, and it was in a book called Sex and Language. It was based, it was published in 1975. It was based on Candace West's master's thesis work. You know, I guess we can probably make some presumptions then that this was kind of her idea that was developed by senior scholar Don Zimmerman.
Do you know if
I was unable to find any kind of details about that relationship?
If he was her advisor,
right? Like, but again, I don't know. It wouldn't be weird if it were. Again, this study publishes a master's thesis pretty shortly before, so let's not speculate. But I would not be shocked if this was her PhD advisor. So, but again, notably, this is, as far as I can tell, the first instance of people studying explicitly cross-gender interruptions. In this study, they are pretty specific about what they're willing to claim. So they say, specifically, we are reporting striking asymmetries between men and women with respect to patterns of interruption, silence, and support for partner in the development of topics. We discuss these observations in this paper and draw implications concerning the larger issue of sexism in American society. Prior to presenting our results, we briefly considered the relationship of our study to language and social interaction. So they're particularly within the framework of social interaction, which is a particular kind of theory of language, sociolinguistic development that says that you kind of learn from your parents, learn from adults, learn from observing more skilled people around you. This would be different from like a biological theory that just says women naturally passive, or, you know, I don't know, a Freudian theory that says like, you know, women don't want to castrate someone or something. So it's specifically about this social interaction that develops these particular skills for communication.
Not to backtrack, but a Freudian theory of women would be that women want to have children and then mother them poorly.
Yes, I believe that is an accurate summary. Yep.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much. That was also a Rodney Dangerfield joke, so I'm 2 for 2.
And so they decided that if they want to study these asymmetries and how they relate to sexism, conversation is one of the best ways to do it, because it's one of the communicative activities you take part in most frequently. And also it has these other features of being kind of both unstructured and yet easily systematizable.
Mm-hmm.
And so this systematization of conversation is based on a model that was proposed by this group of scholars, Sachs, Shegloff, and Jefferson. And so they say that they're going to take this Sachs et al. Turn-taking model and adapt it to studying specifically interruptions, and specifically interruptions between men and women. So they're extending someone else's theory. And they say, you know, we don't view our effort as a contribution to conversational analysis per se, but rather an attempt to apply it to a particular problem. And there's ways that scientists will often really hedge what they're saying. To be like, look, I'm not saying this, I'm only saying this. But throughout this paper, they make hedges that really seem to imply that there is very little support for feminist analysis of language. Mm-hmm. So they, my sense is, and again, I can't prove this. I haven't done the corpus analysis to like look at all papers published in 1975. But my sense is that they really are hedging because they're going out on a limb.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be pretty surprising what going out on a limb looks like. it seems to me like they're clinging to the trunk. So the model they're using here, the Sachs et al. Model, is based, first of all, on the idea that every speech exchange system has two general features. One, mostly a single person talks at a time. And two, the person who is the speaker changes over and over again. So these are the kind of basic premises. If this sounds really basic and really pedantic, hold on.
Because I'm like a person who follows rules and stuff like that, and I want to make sure that I'm doing communication properly, you having two rules, number one, mm-hmm. one person speaks at a time. Number two, the speaker changes over and over. I'm like, good, okay, I do number one and I do number two. Check, check. I'm doing so good at communication right now.
So it is glorious that Zimmerman and West basically summarize it that way. Because, oh boy, the Sachs article is a real thing. So the Sachs et al. Article is 40 pages of
oh my God.
Trying to reverse engineer conversation. It is.
I love scientists so much. So much.
So they took transcripts of conversation. They then...
Were they hiding in bushes with tape recorders?
We're going to talk about recording and transcription methodology in a bit. We don't have time to go into the Sachs methodology. It is...
Will you please just tell me that they were hiding in bushes. With tape
absolutely. It is so bonkers. Okay, so... We're sidetracking here to Sachs because you mentioned this, I've got to talk about it. They say there must be some formal apparatus which is context-free in such ways that it can, in local instances of operation, be sensitive to and exhibit its sensitivity to various parameters of social reality in a local context. And in order to decide on what they call, quote, the simplest systematics for organizing turn-taking, they detail 14 parameters, which will help us determine the simplest systematic. And then,
I am in love with this.
Among
person.
These 14 I, parameters, by the way, when they say there are 14 parameters, there are then two-page footnotes describing what they mean by that. this includes speaker change recurs, or at least occurs. Mm-hmm. Overwhelmingly, one party mm-hmm. talks at a time. So right here, those are the two things that Zimmerman and West, you know, basically summarized. They then detail 12 other things that have to go into the simplest. I emphasize the simplest. This is the title of the article. The simplest systematics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so they detail all of these things at great length. By the way, this list of 14 items is only section 1.1.A of the article. So this thing basically looks like somebody who is trying to make a complicated board game out of conversations. I know that you also are a fan of, or at least a player of, complicated board games.
Oh my God. Beautiful. Stunning, gorgeous, and beautiful. My favorite are, this is too nerdy, so it doesn't matter, but GMT games where the rules manuals are 90 to 400 pages long.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a game for you to play. Yeah.
No, and that's exactly what Sachs et al. Have done. They have mm-hmm. written GMT board game rules for conversation. And in fact, what they come out with is determined to be a rule set for conversation.
Oh my God.
They think that they have reverse engineered conversation.
I love that. I'm so happy.
So it's probably notable then that this is like, you know, this is a period of time where game theory is very, very popular. And so mm-hmm. the idea that you can come up with a systematic explanation for anything is like the gold standard of research, at least social scientific research. Yeah. So Sachs has this just maniacal description of turn-taking methodology that is going to be employed by Zimmerman and West in the article we're actually looking at. And again, one of the reasons that Zimmerman and West say that this is going to be say that conversation is important is because as far as speech exchange systems go, it's really informal, and yet it still seems to follow the pattern. And that is an interesting observation, right? Mm-hmm. You know, they developed this, again, this super complex system, and you could see it playing out, for example, in a debate, where a debate is a thing where you are formalizing rules of speech exchange. You could see it playing out in a, you know, on a TV talk show, but conversations don't have explicit rules, and yet they still end up being explainable with this model. So they import two terms from the Sachs et al. Model. One is a turn. So the first key term is a turn, and a turn is simply an exchange of speakership. So there's a conversation every time someone new speaks. It is a turn. Again, this is sounding like a board game.
It is a board game.
Basically, it is. Yeah. All right. I'm going to say this, and I'm 100% serious right now, but check with me tomorrow. I want to make a conversation board game. Do you want to do this?
Yes, absolutely. Awesome. 100%.
Okay,
yes.
Awesome.
I think we can argue for a few years about what the victory points will be, how absolutely. You obtain mm-hmm. victory absolutely. Points, but absolutely. There is such a huge market for people who find communication in its current form to be tiresome and rules fraught and ridiculous. Yes. So having different, like, what is it called? Different strategies to earn victory points, or different victory tracks to earn victory points from different communication styles. It would be the hit of Gen Con for sure.
I'd actually be shocked if this doesn't already exist.
No, it doesn't. And don't take this idea and come out with this board game in 5 years as opposed to our 20 years that it will take us.
So one of the key terms then is a turn, which is a change of speakership. And also these exchanges of speakership tend to happen, they say, at the end of a unit type, which is a perfectly normal word that a person would use to describe a conversation. What they mean by a unit type...
Sweetie, are you feeling okay? You've hardly taken any unit types tonight.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, so a unit type is... And it's very confusing. Honestly, it's sort of hard to follow. Or it was hard to define, but... By the time I got done with the article, it totally made sense to me. So I don't know. I've been indoctrinated or just broken. I don't know. One of the two. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But a unit type is this sort of, they say, like a projective fragment of speech, meaning that it is not a set unit, but it is a fragment of speech that is defined in its utterance. So if I were to pause right here where it's clear that I'm thinking, I have not reached the end of a unit type. But if I get to the end of a thing, we might consider it at the end of a unit type.
And then I could say something and I could finish my statement and that would be the end of my unit type.
That's correct, right? And so it could be a whole paragraph. Like right now, it seems like I'm winding up to talk about something bigger. And so the unit type that you will understand is much longer. Whereas if I ask you a question... Hey, Christina, do you want to make a weird, nerdy board game about language?
Yes.
So my asking the question indicated where the end of the unit type would be. And when you gave your response, all I needed was one word before I knew that unit type had ended and it was time to change speakers. So again, it's a weird thing to say, but it's a concept that is sort of useful, especially if we want to figure out the dynamics of a conversation. They tend to correspond with grammatical structures, but they could be any grammatical structure. So it's very rare that a unit type will be in the middle of a word, right? But a word could be the end of a unit type. It could be the end of a fragment. It could be a phrase, it could be a clause, it could be a sentence, it could be a paragraph. Mm-hmm. Okay, so those are our ridiculous key terms. Are you ready to look at a flowchart?
I am so excited to look at a flowchart.
All right. So here's a flowchart.
It is gorgeous. It is such a beautiful flowchart.
This flowchart details three decision points in any conversation.
Okay, so you're really incredible at describing shapes, as has been demonstrated. Will you please describe the shapes? The shape?
Yeah.
The shape presentation.
Uh-huh. So I've actually written out a description of these decision points because I knew it was coming, and I knew that I am notoriously amazing at describing things in ways that no other human understands. It looks like a centipede snowman. That's the description I would give. That's not helpful to anyone.
Okay.
Though. So basically how it works.
No, I think it captures it very, very well.
The first
centipede snowman.
The first decision point is basically if the current speaker selects a new speaker, we then recycle back to the top of this flowchart, which is decision point one, but with a new speaker.
Mm-hmm.
So if I say, hey, Christina.
Have I been selected as the next speaker?
You've been selected as the new speaker. And so now you enter the flowchart at position one, and now you speak, and then you get to choose whether or not you want to select the new speaker. If yes, then that speaker takes on the role of speaker and recycles to the top of the flowchart. Okay. In most conversations, you don't, you know, pointedly say, so Christina, tell me more about that. Instead, you more organically don't select the new speaker, in which case we go to decision point two, which is next speaker self-selects. So somebody gets to a point, ideally to the end of a unit type, and that person self-selects. They decide to jump in and say, hey, I've got a comment.
I have self-selected as the next speaker.
Yeah. And so now we're at decision point two. Now from here, if you self-select as the new speaker, we recycle back to the top. And then you are the new speaker, at which point you can select a new speaker or not. If you don't, we flow back into decision point two, which is someone self-selecting. If someone does, we go back to the top. But if no one self-selects, we continue on to decision point three. Decision point three is the current speaker could just continue.
This is so complicated of a flowchart for either the speaker changes or doesn't change.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
That's incredible. That's so beautiful.
It's amazing. I both love and hate this.
I also love that this was before widely available like Word and PowerPoint and all of those processors. Yes. So they had to draw out this flowchart. It is stunning. A stunning flowchart.
But again, it is a flowchart that basically helps you parse how either a person keeps talking or doesn't. And it's important to point out again that this is the level of obsession they're going to. And I really appreciate that. When I was in my 20s, this is exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to do exactly this. I wanted to chart conversations like this and invent terms and make flowcharts. And I don't remember what happened, but I decided not to.
Did you see this flowchart and you're like, I can't compete. It's
too
beautiful.
If I had seen this, I would have put this on the wall and I would have
gotten a tattoo, mm-hmm. looked down at your tattoo and said, you can do it, Martin. Yeah. You too can communicate.
Yeah. there were some more details about the rule set that are, I think we'll skip because I think this is enough is my point. This model is so complicated for almost no reason. But I think it's important to understand it in order to understand what they're on about. So we can move on, I think, instead to the methods. So with the method...
Do you have a methods theme song?
I don't. Or if I do, it'll be here.
All right, we will wait with bated breath to see if there's a methods theme song.
So you were asking before about hiding in bushes. Zimmerman and West did not hide in bushes.
That we know of.
They were actually pretty careful about how they collected their data. So they also wanted to work from transcripts. In order to do that, they wanted to record naturalistic conversations. And so they did that in two ways. The first way was to record what they called, quote, unquote, everyday chit-chat. They did this in what they described as unquestionably public areas. where there is no reasonable expectation of privacy. This is...
Oh my God. They fully were out on campus with reel-to-reel tapes pretending to throw a frisbee back and forth, just recording people walking by. 100%. Absolutely. Or playing hacky sack. Is hacky sack louder than frisbee or quieter?
This is 1974. So there are, it is not necessarily a large reel-to-reel. I believe cassettes existed, and I believe they were accessible. So
don't ruin my reel-to-reel fantasy for me. Absolutely. I picture them with one of those massive microphones with the shield behind
a
it.
A big shotgun mic.
Right? Yeah. And a reel-to-reel with the shoulder strap.
Yeah, yeah.
Going around pretending they don't have the reel-to-reel and just walking up to the people holding the microphone close to them. So beautiful.
I wonder when hacky sack was invented. That's actually the part I'm not sure about, factually.
If hacky sack could be involved here.
Yeah, was it invented in 75? I don't know.
I believe so. I'm going to say yes.
We need a hacky sack scholar. Okay, so they recorded in these, what I took this as, though, was like legal told them, look, we've got to make sure you're covered here. And so unquestionably public spaces where there's no expectation of privacy, they said they got informed consent afterward. So basically they're in a coffee shop with a recorder. They overhear an exchange that they're like, oh, this is something we might want to use. Basically, they're looking for exchanges between two people. They wanted to get like 10 interactions between men, 10 between women, and 11. They wanted 10 that were cross sex, but they got an 11th for a reason I'll talk about in a minute. And so they said, like, after they heard something, they would then ask, hey, we're doing a study. Is it okay if we use it? They said, quote, whenever possible. But sometimes people would like get up and leave or walk away in the middle of a conversation. So in those cases, they weren't able to get informed consent. So again, this is why they're emphasizing they're doing this in very public places. So these were recorded, transcribed, and then double-checked. The transcripts removed identifying information and references, and then the tapes were erased. So again, they want to make extra sure that we all understand that even if they didn't get informed consent, there is no chance that anyone was compromised in this.
Mm.
Which, fair enough, right? It's good to see people trying to be responsible.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this only accounted for 3/4 of the 31 conversation segments they recorded. Christina, do you know what 3/4 of 31 is?
24.
It's not a whole number, for sure. Like, you can't...
Well, maybe they walked from a public place into a private place in the middle of one of their conversations.
Could be. 3/4 of 31. You could just give us a number. You could just say it was 25, like, if you wanted. But they didn't. They said 3/4, just to be confusing. Anyways.
No, to be precise. To be precise. They were on campus, they followed a couple home into their house, and then they walked from the public campus into a private house. So that one is only partially public.
Sure. No, that sounds legit. All right, so mm-hmm. The second type of recordings they made, conversational segments they recorded, they say the remaining 1/4 of the 31 was, quote, in private residences to which the authors normally had casual access. So again, legal is, and for all of these, they got informed consent, which was obtained afterwards. So, okay.
They recorded their dad.
Their friends, family, you know, lab assistants, you assume. Okay. So after they made these recordings, they didn't transcribe, like, you know, all 97 hours that they recorded. They selected segments based on two criteria. One, the segments contained 2 or more noticeable gaps in conversation, and B, the segments contained 2 or more instances of simultaneous speech. Now, it's important that they're saying simultaneous speech here because the study is of interruption, but notably, they are not determining beforehand what an interruption is. And I think this is really smart because one of the things that we now have an intuitive sense for and that Spender talks about later is the notion that often we don't interpret what men do as interruption.
Mm.
And so, like, they're aware enough that even the category of interruption is already biased. It's already laden with gendered meaning. And so they are looking for simultaneous speech. So this is not only kind of good operationalization on like a study design level, but it also is something that is kind of designed to address the inherent sexism of our theoretical categories.
Mm-hmm.
So they end up with like 80 of these segments. And then from that, there's like 30, 10 male to male interactions, 10 female to female interactions. And in both of these situations, they give us a breakdown of the participants. The participants were white, quote, apparently middle class.
Yeah, they're on a college campus.
I
mean,
which,
right?
Fair, I guess, right? But, and then approximately 20 to 35. The fact that the apparently only goes to middle class is, I don't know. Like, we know they're white.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, they're white.
And
for
they're
sure.
Definitely between 20 and 35. We can tell that for sure.
For sure.
Only apparently middle class, though. And the relationships varied, quote, from close friendship to between nurse and patient.
Oh, my God.
So think of everything between close friendship and between nurse and patient. I mean, think of all the things that encompasses, because that's a really normal spectrum to have. So, if Christina, if you think about your coworker, is your coworker closer to close friendship or closer to nurse and patient relationship? Because those are the only two poles of this spectrum.
Also, this is the male to male and female to female. Yep. And I think it's so interesting that we don't know if the nurse and patient is male male or female female. We know it's female female. We could put real money on it being female female.
Sure,
but
could.
There's the possibility that the nurse and patient is male male.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. It is bizarre what they chose to specify and what they decided to leave to our imagination.
Yeah.
So the cross-sex pairs were also white, quote, apparently middle class, under 30. So
they're not between 20 and 35.
Right. Again, I don't know how they know this. They don't tell us. And they're all university students except for one.
This is so weird.
It is very, very weird. Here, relationships, quote, varied from intimacy to first-time acquaintanceship. So anywhere between intimate to first time acquaintance, with one instance of a formal status relationship.
What is a formal status relationship? Is that like boss and...
The formal status relationship was, they said, between a woman TA and a male student. And they were not intending to include this, but evidently, I guess the TA must have just recorded this. And this was the only instance they found of a woman interrupting a man. So they decided to include it.
Is it possible that West is the TA and she was recording herself?
Oh, you know what? That sounds very likely, actually, now that you mention it. That's almost certainly true. Yeah. I'd forgotten what it was to be a lab assistant. So that's definitely it. The other important part of this model is that they have decided to define kind of two separate types of interaction, of simultaneous speech. Overlaps and interruptions. Overlaps are these instances of simultaneous speech where a speaker other than the current speaker begins to speak at or very close to the possible transition point, the end of a unit type in a speaker's current utterance, which is a very normal way of saying an overlap is where one person starts talking pretty much right after another person does.
Mm-hmm.
If I start talking over your last word, and these are considered, they say, errors indigenous to the speaker transition process. So this is just someone who accidentally starts talking too soon, but at the end of a thought.
Mm-hmm.
Interruptions, on the other hand, they are, quote, penetrating the boundaries of a unit type prior to the last lexical constituent that could define a possible terminal boundary of a unit type.
Wow.
So again, a real normal person way of saying, you know, the person isn't done, but you start talking.
Oh my God. I need to memorize this. So the next time I'm interrupted, I can say, you have penetrated the boundaries of a unit type prior to the last lexical constituent that could define my possible terminal boundary of my unit type.
You could absolutely say that.
You know the part of Lord of the Rings where Galadriel becomes the demon character? I need to become the demon, right? And say, you have penetrated the boundaries of a unit type.
We're absolutely going to talk about, actually, about
Galadriel in the Lord of the Rings.
Absolutely. Have I ever told you about the study published in QJS about elf language?
Oh my God, no.
It's a huge distraction. Okay. We will talk later about what you're talking about, though, like calling someone out, sanctions. We're going to talk about that later. So kind of the summary, though, is that basically interruptions are violations of a speaker's rights to complete a turn.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got their data, their recordings, they transcribe them, they're looking for overlaps. They then go ahead and analyze the instances of overlaps and interruptions. So, we got a table.
Gorgeous.
It's a nice looking table.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that you might notice about the table, though. First, they cluster both of the same sex segments together. So they're not distinguishing in this table between the male-male and female-female interactions, primarily because they said basically there were too few of them. And so you'll notice in parentheses there, you've got the N in parentheses. And they're real low.
Mm-hmm.
So, they're distinguishing here between first speaker and second speaker, just who got interrupted or overlapped. This isn't the person who initiated the entire conversation. It's just, you know, in this local interaction.
So they're saying men don't really interrupt men and women don't really interrupt women when you record them on a reel-to-reel tape on a university campus.
Yeah, it's not really common, but really, what the reason this is interesting is not that basically both partners tended to interrupt each other and overlap with each other roughly the same amount in same-sex exchanges. They tended to be pretty balanced in terms of interruption and overlap. But when we look at interruptions and overlaps in the 11 cross-sex conversation segments, we see that men interrupted women 46 times. And women interrupted men 2 times. And again, those 2 were a TA interrupting a student.
Mm-hmm.
That men overlapped with women 9 times. And that's about comparable to same-sex overlaps, right? Same-sex overlaps were about 9 or 10. And that women never overlapped with men. So again, the overlap is just the kind of anticipatory simultaneity.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing they wanted to do was make sure that since these ends are so low, they wanted to make sure that it wasn't being unusually influenced by a single participant, so that there wasn't just like one male who was interrupting one female, you know, 46 times,
mm-hmm.
and it was just one, you know, one person. So they noted that 10 out of the 11 cross-sex segments, there was an interruption. Now, the range here was between 2 and 13, so it's a pretty broad span, but the mean was 4.2.
Mm-hmm.
But here's what's notable. That 13, that outlier, was the TA being interrupted by her male student.
Oh my God.
So we've included this as this instance where there was a woman interrupting a man, but she was out-interrupted, you know, by 7 times.
Did they specify where in the conversation her interruptions were? Like, was it at the end of the conversation after she had been interrupted 13 times?
It does not specify that. And the sense you get, because they don't give us full transcripts, but the sense you get is that the interruptions happened, is that she was trying to explain a concept to this student. And so she was like trying to head off his wrongness and he would just interrupt her back. So.
Mm. I am fully in the fan theory that this was the author
Absolutely. Talking
to one of her students, right?
Absolutely.
And she published a whole entire paper with the main standout data from the paper being how much her student interrupted her.
Absolutely. I 100% believe that. Yeah. Yep. So, you know, their kind of summary of this is that 3 out of 20 same-sex segments contained an interruption. So interruptions in same-sex contexts were sort of anomalous, whereas they were basically ubiquitous in cross-sex conversation. So that is kind of their analysis of those data.
Mm-hmm. I wonder on a meta level if it matters who is doing the recording, like if the recording is being done by a real person versus if the recording isn't an object that's not identified. Because there's absolutely the performance part, right? Like, the are men performing for a woman that they find attractive, or are men talking in front of a woman that they don't find attractive? Like, that level of interaction wouldn't be able to be identified from such a small data set. And I'm sure someone has done that.
And this is a really nice thing. Zimmerman and West say, like, we cannot generalize these data. The numbers are too small. Our methodology was not controlled enough.
Our subjects were between 20 and 30 years old on a university campus.
Exactly. So, like, they are very cautious, saying we can't say this is a universal phenomenon. What they're saying is, if we use this method of looking for interruptions, here's what we find. Mm-hmm. And so certainly I'm sure they would have been very excited to, you know, for people to like dig in a little deeper with this. It seems to be what they're after with this study. So in addition to interruptions or overlaps, the study was about interruptions and silences. So they also have an analysis of silences. So they say, since the conversation rule set, can't command anyone to take a turn, lapses or silences will occur. Remember, going back to that flow chart, right? There's all these decision points. And if we get to the bottom of the flow chart, all we have is like the original speaker might decide to speak again, or he might not.
He or she, Martin.
You got that. Nice.
We're talking about Dale Spender here. We must use they might decide not.
That is I was trying to see if I could sneak one through, honestly.
Absolutely not. Yeah, right. No. I am hyper vigilant.
Good. Since the conversational rule set doesn't allow for anyone to command anyone to do anything, there's going to be these silences. And so they wanted to study these silences in kind of a comparative ratio way between the pairs. And so once again, we get some sort of labored calculus that happens here. So they divide the total seconds of silence that happened after the less silent speaker spoke by the total number of seconds of silence that followed the more silent speaker.
It absolutely sounds like you're doing Peter Piper picked a pep of paper peppers.
It does.
The seconds of silence by the silent speaker by the seconds of silence by the more silent speaker.
Their goal was for equity the equity should be 1.0. They just wanted to represent it that way. Fine, whatever. So they're finding a ratio. They only included silences at transitions between speakers, not internal silences. Because this is a turn-taking model, they're not interested in a person who pauses and then continues speaking on their own. Mm-hmm. And they note that this doesn't actually take into account the quality of these silences. Is it someone stopping to think? Is it someone, who has left a dramatic pause, after what they said, because there was some finality to it. But they say that basically the results are so huge that it kind of doesn't matter. Like, these results aren't being skewed by like some kind of minor thing. So they present a chart that looks basically like nonsense.
It looks like a child got a stamp and stamped their wall in a random pattern. Yeah,
there is a number line that goes from 0 to 1. Again, this is their ratio of silence, ratio of least silent to most silent. And then they're placing the conversations, the 31 segments, on this number line. And they've basically like got three
stratospheres. There's the female stratosphere, the male stratosphere, and the male female stratosphere.
That's it. Yes. Talking about strata is the way to talk about it. Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so the female to female stratum is kind of shows that they're basically always between 0.6 and 1. And the 0.6 is kind of an outlier. It's mostly between 0.8 and 1, which means that they're pretty close to equity in terms of silence. Who is silent?
In terms of pausing, mm-hmm. Yeah.
The male to male is mostly clustered, between kind of 0.6 and 0.9, with one way down at 0.4. So again, they're mostly clustered above 0.6, so like kind of equitable, But that said, like the female, the lowest was 0.6. So, you know, for the cross-sex pairings, they didn't bother to do it like kind of least silent versus most silent. They just did it male versus female because those Venn diagrams overlapped, you know, as a circle.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got basically the highest equity is at 0.6. The highest ratio of equity is 0.6, which is lower than the lowest female to female equity. And mm-hmm. the lowest equity is zero, which evidently means that one person there was never silence.
Never stopped talking. Yeah. It's the person who interrupted 12 times.
You would assume, right?
But there's also multiple people at that really low level of equity.
There are.
Yeah.
So like, yeah, the 0.6 at the top, the most equitable, is actually, you know, again, kind of outside the cluster. But the point being here, right, there's lots of equity in female to female. There's reasonable equity in male to male. And cross-sex equity is basically lower than either of the same-sex cluster. And so this
there's no equity.
Right. And so this is why they're saying, like, they're just trying to make kind of gross determinations about this. They're just pointing out this big picture phenomenon. So one of the things they did observe about these silences is that a large proportion of female sciences in the cross-gender segments, a large portion of them were products of what they called male-initiated events. They say 62% of the female aggregate silence in the cross-sex segments followed upon three types of events in the preceding turns: a delayed minimal response by the male, an overlap by the male, or an interruption by the male. 62% of aggregate female silence happened after one of these three male-initiated events happened. The first one they talk about then is these delayed minimal responses.
I love I know this is another thing and it's another language thing, but the passive voice instead of the active voice. So instead of saying men interrupted women, men overlapped mm-hmm. women, and men had delayed minimal responses mm-hmm. to women, they say mm-hmm. male initiated responses, mm-hmm. right? The thing that happened mm-hmm. is the initiated response. Yep. It was initiated by yep. a male, but it's not men yep. interrupting. Yeah. It's a male-initiated response.
And in fact, I said before, like, they do a lot of moderating of their language in this article, like,
yeah.
more so even than most science papers. You know, maybe this was the thing at the time. Maybe you really did have to use as much passive voice at the time. But it really kind of stands out that they use passive voice and really, like, moderate their claims pretty heavily. And I wouldn't be surprised if it is because of the subject matter, but going back to Spender, we could also just argue that, like, it's a product of the science language. Like, science language mm-hmm. allows for this to happen through its passive construction.
Right. They would have to
violate, like, the norms.
Obviously, yeah, they'd have to violate norms. They'd have to, it would be seen as accusatory mm-hmm. and aggressive and all of those things to say, yeah. men interruptions is why women aren't speaking. Yeah. It would be seen as very biased in a progressive or different or changing way versus just saying this is a neutral observation that we have neutrally made. We have no stake in this game. We are very neutral people who don't have an opinion on anything that's happening.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And anybody saying that you need to speak about this more neutrally would be able to hide behind the stylistic convention of science writing. So there's right. immediate plausible deniability. They eliminate some of these male-initiated events from their analysis. They stop counting those silences that follow a male-initiated event, and they place stuff on the number line again, and basically they find that the cross-gender equity increases a little bit, but is basically still below the female-to-female equity, like mm-hmm. with, again, just like some very minor exceptions, with two outliers, basically. So again, they try to take those out and find that even with those taken out, there's still huge inequity. But they do then go on to really talk about these male-initiated events and what effect they have. So they're not the whole story, but they do some interesting things. So the first thing they want to do when they talk about delayed minimal responses is they want to talk about, well, what is a minimal response? Have you heard about minimal responses in communication before?
Is it just like a verbal, like, mm-hmm?
That's exactly it. Yeah. They show that you're paying attention. They show that you're actively listening. Mm-hmm. And notably, they're encouraging. It's, you know, Yeah, say more. Yeah, great. Oh, yeah, I agree. Uh-huh, uh-huh. Like, it's encouragement to continue.
The kids now, the Gen Zs, would say less as an encouraging response. So just so that's very clear, say less means I agree with you. I'm on your level. I feel your vibe. I like what you're saying. It doesn't mean say fewer words. It means I'm already there. I already agree with you. So let's not be exclusionary towards the youth.
But that's fascinating because that is a minimal response. It is a minimal response because it's just this kind of short phrase, say less. But it is also an indication that your response ought to be minimal. It's a meta minimal response. So minimal responses are like kind of good things generally, or neither of these are positive or negative, I guess. But they often encourage continued speech is the point. And one of the important factors of them is that they need to be timely. So if I'm talking and you give a minimal response, like after I make a point or kind of, you know, as I'm talking, I will take that as encouraging. But if I get done speaking, I'll take that laughter as a minimal response. And you offer no response. And then you sort of say, uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great.
Well, again, it ought to be a minimal, so it's just a kind of, uh-huh, sure. After a long pause, it no longer functions as encouragement. In fact, this is their interpretation, is that it instead functions as discouragement, as a sign that mm-hmm. you actually aren't invested, that you aren't interested. And the reason they're drawing this conclusion is because they find that the mean female silence after a minimal delayed response, so that's a delayed response that is more than a second after a person stopped talking. The average cross-sex delay, the obvious cross-sex silence after a delayed minimal response was 3.85 seconds. In same-sex interactions, a delayed minimum response would result in only 1.4 seconds of silence. So what they determined was that these delayed minimum responses were not encouraging. In fact, when men used them with women, they were a way to discourage them from speaking more.
Mm-hmm.
They noted a similar thing with interruptions, right? After being interrupted, women would be silent on average for 3.14 seconds. If a man interrupted them, if a woman interrupted them, they were silent for about 1 second. So these silences and the minimal responses, delayed minimal responses, led to increased silence. Interruptions and delayed minimal responses led to increased silence on the part of women.
I feel very called out right now because I get interrupted all the time because I'm not a forceful uh-huh. speaker. And then after I get interrupted, I'm like, oh, this person is not interested in what I'm saying. So I will be done talking now.
As we said at the beginning, this is not, you shouldn't feel called out by that. That is a structural component of cross-gender communication. Mm-hmm. That's what's supposed to happen. You didn't do it wrong. You did it right. It's just that
I'm letting the patriarchy control me.
Right. But again, that's how language is set up. You are supposed to be mm-hmm. controlled by the patriarchy through language. So none mm-hmm. of this is, you know, saying it's like your fault, you've done something wrong would be ridiculous. Instead, you have accurately learned how to speak. It just so happens, though, that your role in speech is mostly to be silent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things from Man Made Language, I can't remember who said it, but Dale Spender quoted another feminist scholar, and the other feminist scholar said, of course men think women talk too much, they're measuring women against silence. So any speech against silence will always be too much.
When I'm doing a lecture, I love it when my students mention something that's on my next slide.
Oh, is it really?
I love it because it means
we're on the path together.
Exactly. Yeah. So the exact quote was, and this wasn't in quotes in the book. So I think this was Spender's analysis of I think there's a simple explanation for the way in which we have been conned into thinking that women speak more than men. The talkativeness of women has been gauged in comparison not with men, but with silence.
In the copy of the book that I have, someone who had it before they returned it to the library marked all over the book, and that part was like underlined, star.
It's huge. Like that's, yeah. Mm-hmm. And Spender is drawing that conclusion in part from this, right? Clearly she's understanding this study as supporting mm-hmm. that claim. One thing she noted too is that there was only one instance of a woman, and we talked about this earlier, sanctioning a man after she was interrupted. That is to say, a woman saying, hey, what's going on? You interrupted me. And she notes that sanctions are kind of a double-edged sword because, yeah, you're kind of calling someone out, but they are themselves a topic change. So mm-hmm. if you are trying to talk about something and someone interrupts you and you wanted to continue that topic, arguably your best strategy is just to like wait for that person to get done with their interruption, give it some silence, and then continue. Because if you say, mm-hmm. what are you doing, buddy? Now you're going to have a conversation about that. And so this kind of goes to their conclusion. They say, while we cannot demonstrate it here, we believe that both delayed mental responses and interruptions function as topic control mechanisms. For example, if delayed mental responses are indeed signals of non-support for the continued development of a topic by one speaker over a series of turns, or by continuation of the same topic, a series of delayed responses should serve at minimum to bring the topic to a close. We observed this pattern in 3 of the 10 male-female transcripts.
Mm-hmm.
So that long pause and then uh-huh, and then long pause basically kills the flow of that topic,
mm-hmm.
both by showing lack of interest or even more neutrally, just by not encouraging continuation of that topic. As you said, like, oh, I guess they're bored. I'll talk about something else.
Yeah. And on a personal level, one of my obsessions that I am truly ashamed of is how much I read Reddit relationship posts, like relationship advice and all that stuff. But the number of posts by women who are saying, I've tried to talk about XYZ problem with my partner, and he just doesn't engage. He doesn't say anything. It's impossible to talk to him. It's absolutely a topic control mechanism of he doesn't want mm-hmm. to talk about mm-hmm. this problem. So he doesn't talk about it. And therefore,
we don't talk about
controls,
it.
controls the topic. Yeah.
Another thing that's kind of a well-established bit in gender communication is that women tend to be responsible for what they call like kind of maintenance work in a conversation, mm-hmm. conversational maintenance. So making sure that the topic continues is women's work in a conversation. And, you know, that is another factor here, is that making sure that the conversation keeps flowing, making sure people feel included is work that women do in conversation. It's supposed to be every listener's job to maintain things. It falls mostly to women. And if a man goes, you know, directly against it, arguably the thing to do to maintain the conversation then is to change the topic.
On a pause, not related at all, my computer is almost dead, so I have to run downstairs and grab my charger. Be right back.
We were talking then about these kind of topic control mechanisms and basically how these delayed mental responses and interruptions are assertions of the right to control the topic.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they suggest that they had looked into interruption and silence as topic control in adult child pairings, and the cross-sex patterns looked closer to that than they did like same-sex interactions.
Oh, that's depressing.
Yeah, we might think it's appropriate for like adults to direct children in conversation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially if we're taking this social interaction theory approach to communication, that's actually what should happen. Adults ought to be training children as to how to interact.
Mm-hmm.
But that has some sort of distressing implications if, again, the same pattern is followed by men with women.
It's the My Fair Lady of language, of like teaching women exactly how you want them to present, exactly how you want them to communicate, what topics they can talk about, what they can't talk about.
Yeah, I think that's perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. If you want to be part of society, mm-hmm. if you want to participate in society, this is how society is set up. You have to do it this way. Otherwise, you don't get to be in society.
And he gets to do it by appealing to totally neutral grammar. You know, this is proper mm-hmm. pronunciation. Like, that's all I'm teaching you is mm-hmm. how to do things properly. Yeah, damn.
Is My Fair Lady the totally legitimate pop culture reference?
It's a bonus one. It's a bonus one, for sure. I like it. Hell yeah. So they conclude the article by then taking some steps. And this is where they actually do start to say some stuff. So they say, kind of, in affecting the distribution of turns, the operation of the turn-taking system determines the distribution of resources for accomplishing interactional events through conversation. Introducing and developing topics, for example. So this turn-taking mechanism is about distributing the resources of the conversation. Mm-hmm. So they say, men deny equal status to women as conversational partners with respect to rights to full utilization of their turn and support of their developed topics. Thus, we speculate that just as male dominance is exhibited through male control of macro institutions in society, it is also exhibited through control of at least a part of one micro institution.
Is this the first instance of like microaggression or the proto instance of microaggression?
It is kind of approaching that. Yeah. I was taking it more though as like a version of the feminist, you know, edict, like, you know, the personal is political, mm-hmm. which is not unrelated to the microaggression idea, right? It's all part of this kind of same, you know, feminist analysis soup. But so I like this because this is where they're sort of asserting that, like, look, this is a structural issue. But then, like, this turn they take at the end is so, again, so much hedging. Like, there's male dominance exhibited in macro institutions. But maybe it's possible that kind of the same thing happens in at least one part of one micro institution. Like, mm-hmm. they're not willing to, you know, Spender is saying, like, language is part of culture, so language is sexist too. And they're like, we could consider that maybe it's at least part of this little. So
in this whole entire paper where their data supports that men interrupt yeah. women, do they ever once say, just in plain language, men interrupt women?
Yes, they do. They do. Yes, yes. And they say throughout that, like, again, it's wildly disproportionate. And yet, you know, I don't know if they ever say, like, sexism. I don't know if that is a term that ever shows up.
Well, sexism wasn't invented until 1997.
I do remember that. So. Yeah. no, that's right. In the introduction, they talked about sexism. They say that this is like part of a larger issue of sexism in American society. But again, they are sort of cagey about their claims. Yeah, the last thing I had here was actually just a return to Dale Spender. I literally had that, like, you know, talkativeness of women is being engaged in compressed into silence as, like, you know, mm-hmm. that is the strong statement of the claim they're making. The claim they made was that, you know, men are controlling turn taking and establishing that women don't have a right to take a turn.
Yeah, exactly. The context of the quote was that it kind of doesn't matter what percentage of the time women actually speak versus the percentage of the time men actually speak, because women aren't being engaged against men. Women are being engaged against silence. So they will always be considered to be too talkative, too present, too loud, too everything. Because everything greater than zero is too much. Exactly. Yeah. And it doesn't matter if they're only speaking 40% versus men speaking 60%. They're gauged to have the right to speak 0%. Yeah. So it doesn't matter. Yep.
Yeah, so...
That was quite a long pause that you just took there, Martin. That was maybe approaching 4 seconds of a pause after I made a very... impressive point about conversation and feminism.
It was, and I was attempting. I was indeed attempting to change the subject. I am open to criticism of that. My reasoning, however, is that this is not simply a conversation. This is, in fact, a show. Therefore,
are you recording this?
I was going to tell you afterward. I've been hiding in a bush. I was, in fact, going to transition topics, not out of lack of interest, more out of just, like, I don't know, what can I say after that? You're right. And so we've got a few more things we want to talk about before we go.
What do you want to talk about before we go? Please select our next appropriate and approved topic of conversation.
Look, you did assign me this topic. You did tell me that I had to talk about Dale Twenger.
I said, Dr. Martin, talk to me for 4 hours about Dale Spender. And you said, okay.
It's true. I did agree.
That is really what happened in real life. I didn't
disagree on any level. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I think is really, really interesting, the end of Man-Made Language, Spender starts talking about the importance of naming. And again, kind of the authority to name things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know. Short history lesson. In 1963, Betty Friedan wrote the book, you know, the Problem Without a Name, or That Has No Name, The Problem That Has No Name. And she was kind of talking about middle-class white women who have everything they could desire in terms of like a house and a family and kids and a husband, but are just like unhappy. And so mm-hmm. they would go to psychologists who are like, I don't know, man. I can't help you, you know?
I would prescribe you a house and a husband and children and a car or a two-car garage.
Exactly. Friedan kind of notes that until we get words for describing this, there was no way for women to approach it. And so it would come up in like on women's reading groups or women's, you know, other types of groups where they would all get together and say like, yeah, I have this thing too. And it's like the fact that it didn't have a name made it kind of inaccessible. And so Spender mm-hmm. kind of extends that. And of course, there is a wider conversation beyond Friedan. Friedan's not the only person saying that. But Spender talks about the importance of naming and being able to name things. She has this exchange between two women. And so one of them says, I often find there aren't any words to say what I mean. The other woman says, oh, what's something you want a word for that there just isn't a word for? And the first woman says, I'd like a word for the next time I complain about doing the cooking and the cleaning. And my husband says, but dear, you're so good at it. I want a word that describes what he's doing. Getting out.
Weaponized incompetence. Exactly.
So this is one of the things where Spender was clearly correct. And not that mm-hmm. there's tons of places where I think she's wrong, but like this is so pertinent, is that in 1980, there's this story of this woman saying, like, I need to be able to explain this phenomenon. In the book, Spender never says, like, weaponized incompetence. I think there kind of wasn't a common term for it at that point. And she says, like, mm-hmm. this is a problem because men can just say, like, oh, I was complimenting you. Like, what's the problem? And, mm-hmm. you know, but we now have the term weaponized incompetence. So we can then criticize that.
And identify it and speak to each other mm-hmm. about it and have solutions directed towards it.
When I brought this up to my gender comm class last year, they were all about it. They were able to talk about it. They all were like, yes, this is why I have to do the laundry all the time.
The whole building shaking with the resonance of everyone at the same time shouting, weaponized incompetence.
Seriously, kind of it concretizes so much faster with the term. And so one word that we now have...
Is it time for the definitely legitimate pop culture reference of the day?
It is time for the definitely legitimate pop culture reference of the day. So, of the day here actually means 2016 or something.
Oh, anything after 1970
is of
the day.
Oh, here we go. Published January 14th, 2015. So almost exactly 9 years ago. but what?
2015 wasn't 9 years ago. How silly.
So this was an article in Time magazine called How Not to Be Manterrupted in Meetings.
No. No.
Explain that. Explain your response.
No. Manterrupted. How to not be manterrupted. Okay, so very obviously from the title, this is aimed at women, teaching women on how to correct erroneous behavior from men. The onus is on women to do the work to make themselves heard instead of on men to listen to women. Right?
I mean, so you nailed it. I mean, that's entirely it. Yeah.
Yeah. You are allowing yourself to be manterrupted. If you read my book and by my class and buy the second version of my book and come to my seminars. Yeah. If you give me money, you will learn how to not be a bad woman who allows herself to be man-terrupted.
Funny you say, buy my book. This article is about the concept of man-terruption as articulated by one Sheryl Sandberg. Are you familiar with Sheryl Sandberg?
I am not familiar with
Sheryl Sandberg. Is a woman, an executive, who wrote a book by the name of Lean In. And so...
Oh, I've heard of this. It sounded horrible, so I didn't read it.
Correct. Lean In is a book that basically does exactly what you said. It gives instructions to women that if you are being talked over, you just need to talk louder. You know, if men take credit for your ideas, you just need to make sure you write your name on everything. If you know, you're not getting paid the same as men, you should go negotiate for more. If they tell you you didn't negotiate right, figure out what you did wrong and negotiate better.
Do they tell you to like project a hologram of a man in front of you at all times? So when people look at you, they see a man and then they're more receptive to the things that you're about to say to them. And also you have a voice modulator so that your voice, which might sound feminine, no longer suffers from sounding too feminine and sounds more masculine and acceptable as you speak. Does the book Lean In come with a shrink-wrapped voice modulator attached to the front of the book?
No, because that would be cheating. You just need to work harder to modulate your own voice. It should not surprise you that Sheryl Sandberg was an executive for Facebook, now Meta. She's a COO for Meta. So she is a person whose opinion we could maybe take with a grain of salt.
Yeah, this sounds so silly and so trivial now. But the first time I heard, not there should be more women CEOs, there should be fewer CEOs, right? Like that concept of it's not a matter of promoting women to, quote, men's spaces, but of changing the spaces that exist. I was like, whoa, holy shit.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And Sandberg is the opposite of that.
She's a woman in a, quote, man's world, in a man space, COO of Meta.
And consequently, her advice is just be like me.
Be like a man.
Yeah, exactly. So this is maybe the second half of the definitely legitimate pop culture reference of the day, is that I would highly recommend the podcast Lean Back, which is done by...
A song by Lil Jon.
Precisely. Yep. Precisely. It is a podcast about Lil Jon.
No. It's like Fat Joe and Terror Squad.
Yeah, Fat Joe.
Yeah.
Remy Ma and Terror Squad.
Yeah, yes.
This is hip-hop from the 2000s, so I have no connection to it.
I have absolute 100% connection to this song.
That is sort of surprising to me.
Oh my God. I listened to so much KDWB, you have no idea.
That's ridiculous. No, I was referring to a podcast by Lisa Corrigan and Laura Wiedershoff.
I don't know if you noticed, but I just tried to control the conversation and make us talk about early 2000s hip hop instead of this podcast.
Like I said, I have the advantage of plausible deniability that this is not a conversation. This is a show. And therefore, the speech exchange template for it is different. Though, notably, the Sax et al. Model is extensible to all speech exchanges.
All speech exchanges.
I mean, it is the simplest systematic description of turn-taking. So one of its features is that it is context-free. I didn't talk about that because it seemed like you're going too deep. But yes, I am turning the topic back as part of my prerogative.
Away from Remy
as a man and as the... and due to my status as the ostensible host of this episode.
Oh my God.
Again, if you don't like that, let's go back to you being in charge. It's honestly way less work for me. And you're so good at it. You're so much better at it. If you could just host every episode.
Is there a class to teach me how to man-terrupt you so I can talk about Remy Ma more than we have currently talked about Remy Ma?
And I'm sure Sheryl Sandberg will sell you this course for only $39.95. as a subscription.
Okay, so we'll do part two of this episode where I learn how to talk about Remy Ma, how to force people who might not be interested in talking about Remy Ma to talk about Remy Ma.
I was just mentioning because it is honestly one of my favorite podcasts, and I highly recommend it. It's basically a feminist podcast, and the title is a response to the Lean In as a nonsense concept.
Is their intro song Lean Back by Fat Joe and
I can recommend it. I'm sure they've thought of it.
Thank you.
Probably a licensing issue. The other thing I was going to do as a definitely legitimate pop culture reference of the day is there is an app called Woman Interrupted that allows you to record conversations, and it will then analyze like percentage interruptions of men and women.
Oh my God.
And so I was thinking about just sending our whole conversation through that and then asking you after the fact, like a good researcher. But I didn't, because absolutely they are harvesting all kinds of other data in addition to just doing the analysis. So I decided not to use that, as fun as it would have been to analyze our conversation. It probably makes more sense just to hire a research assistant to code it instead.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Someone should get on that.
Well, if we get rich on podcasting, we would have enough money to hire a research assistant to go through our many hours of podcasts and come up with numbers. And flowcharts.
So many flowcharts.
Oh, my God.
Oh, also, if we're going to be old school about it, you could totally marry that research assistant.
I could marry the research assistant. I am very interested in marrying the flowchart that you presented. So we would have to live in a state where a woman could marry a flowchart and a research assistant. Yeah. But
marriage is between one woman, one flowchart, and one research assistant. If that is your platform, you have my vote. I don't know. I think that's all I have.
Well, we learned so much.
Yeah, I thought it was fun. Like I said, you gave me an assignment, and I went in a slightly different direction with it. But I think we did end up with, I don't know, something I found satisfying.
I'm absolutely going to be on my deathbed just asking, where did that factoid come from? Yeah, where did those numbers come from?
I totally intended to look for those, but again, just got distracted by something more interesting.
More interesting.
I'm not a numbers person.
You said a lot of numbers. I said so many numbers. Not being a numbers person.
It was real hard. I'm not going to lie. I didn't like it. I think probably the best solution would be for next week for you to say numbers so I don't have to.
Yeah. So next week we can do the bystander effect.
Oh, nice.
Because that one has a lot of numbers in it, but the bystander effect of how different numbers of people impact your likelihood to respond to an emergency.
Great. Yeah. Okay. I'm excited.
So join us next week when we may experience emergencies and may or may not receive help for them. Yes.
All right. Well, I'll see you next week.
Oh, bye.